This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Early this month, Singapore Press Holdings announced that it will hive off its media business into a not-for-profit company. SPH is the publisher of The Straits Times, as you may know. So what are the implications of this move for media and journalism in Singapore? Joining me to discuss this is Sherian George, Professor of Media Studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University. Good morning, Sherian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Shazana. Thanks for having me on.
So for those of us who are unfamiliar with the Singapore media landscape, can we start with getting a picture of the kind of presence that SPH has in Singapore media and why the decision to spin off the media segment? Why is it seen as such a big deal?
Well, SPH, Singapore Press Holdings, was formed in the 1980s as a result of a merger of the English and Malay newspaper group and the Chinese media group. So what Malaysians are very familiar with, the Straits Times, which of course was always headquartered in Singapore, the New Straits Times spun off from it in the 1970s. The Straits Times group is, I guess, the cash cow of SPH. It has an absolute monopoly of the daily newspaper business in Singapore. So every local daily newspaper in all four languages is published by SPH. The other big player in Singapore's media landscape is Mediacorp, which started out as Radio Television Singapore, right? The sister of RTM in Malaysia, gradually corporatized. Now it's 100% government-owned commercial entity. Malaysians may be familiar with Channel News Asia, which is a Mediacorp channel. So essentially, Singapore's mainstream media landscape is dominated by these two giants, SPH, Mediacorp. SPH is commonly but mistakenly perceived as owned by Temasek, the Singapore government's investment arm. That's actually not true. Temasek owns a very small part of SPH. It's mainly owned by institutional and individual investors. So it's a private newspaper group. The big change that was announced this month is that SPH, which has since evolved into a property player and so on, like many other media companies, has been dragged down by the poor financial performance of its media properties. And so it's, SPH has decided, of course, in consultation with the government, to hive off the entire media business into something called SPH Media, which will be a non-profit company. So it's a major restructuring of Singapore's media. I can't think of any other country in the advanced world where there will no longer be profit-driven media. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's quite a major change.
Right. And SPH is not state-owned media. It's private, as you said.
That's right. Yes.
But at the same time, we understand that there are controls that the government has over media entities like SPH, correct? Even though they're private, it's still seen as linked to the government or closely affiliated, aligned with the government?
Yes, so it is a very ingenious system of behind-the-scenes control. In the 1970s, I guess Malaysia and Singapore diverged in their leaders' perception of what they needed to do in order to supervise media. Both authoritarian in their own way, both, convinced that, to put it euphemistically, for the sake of the national interests and mm-hmm. national development, the government needed to have a hand in media. Malaysia did something more typical, which is to decide that, well, if they want to have control of a media content, they need to own it. And so essentially what happened in Malaysia is, you know better than me, it involved a party or proxy takeover of the New Straits Times group. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there were all these, of course, communist countries that went all the way and nationalized their media, right? And so you have media that are directly owned by the state. Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew decided on a very different path. He quite astutely understood that he didn't need to own media in order to control it. Mm. He actually trusted that commercial businesses tend to be quite conservative, especially if the government is pro-business anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So he actually entrusted Singapore's newspapers to the stock market and didn't actually see the need for the government to control a large part of it. Mm. What he did do, though, was to make it impossible for any private owner to become a media mogul, to control a large part of the media.
So no Rupert Murdoch will come up in Singapore.
Exactly. No Rupert Murdoch, but more to bring it more in local terms, what he had experienced in preceding years were Chinese family owners who, because they had other businesses, didn't really need to make a profit from their newspapers, and so could actually use their newspapers to fulfill other goals, cultural goals, political goals, ideological goals, promotion of Chinese language, and so on. The newspapers were seen as a prestige product, a cultural product, and so on. And I think Lee Kuan Yew, ahead of his time, recognized that that was the picture, right? To say he didn't actually need to fear businessmen who were purely driven by profit. He actually needed to fear businessmen who had their money from other sources and were quite committed to preserving their newspapers, fulfilling a political purpose, even if the newspaper lost money. Right, so that's what he wanted to make extinct. And he did it with this new law in 1974, the Newspaper and Printing Presses Act, that basically said that no shareholder can control above a certain proportion of shares. So that now stands at 12%. So that was one part of it. The other ingenious part of it is that, okay, not all shareholders will be treated equally. There will be a class of super voting shares or management shareholders. And government gets to decide who controls management shares. So in dollar value, it's the same as ordinary shares, but management shareholders have 200 times the voting power of ordinary shareholders. And management shares were given not only to government-linked companies like Singapore Telecom, DBS, but also to non-government-linked banks like OCBC, Great Eastern Life, UOB, and so on. Again, because the PAP was astute enough to recognize that the business community, it had no interest in rocking the political boat. You know, as long as the economy was doing well in Singapore, the businessmen are generally averse to political risk, not interested in democratic experimentation, would much prefer the status quo. But by giving these mainly financial institutions, conservative institutional owners, these extra voting rights, the government essentially had a backdoor route to naming the board of directors of any newspaper, and thus to appointing the top editors of the newspaper.
I see.
So through this mechanism, without needing to actually own newspapers, they've been able to install very conservative boards, CEOs, and editors-in-chief of newspapers.
I see. Turning to the most recent developments then, you acknowledged in your commentary in the South China Morning Post that on the surface, the decision to turn SPH into a not-for-profit media trust is a radical and forward-thinking idea, but at the same time, you don't think it will make a difference in terms of the quality of journalism. And that's one of the benefits put forth by the SPH management when they announced this deal, that turning SPH into a not-for-profit media company would improve the quality of journalism. So why do you disagree with this assertion?
Well, one word, competition, right? I mean, I think this supposedly new formula is still a highly monopolistic one. They've retained the 100-year-old colonial tradition of requiring licenses, which of course Malaysia, I believe, still has as well. This was the permit system is something that was installed by our colonial masters to tame subjects, right? You know, why are sovereign citizens subject to the same century-old law, right? So as long as that's the case, you know, and as long as only approved entities, in this case only one giant newspaper, gets to play the game, you know, common sense tells us that without adequate competition, you're not going to see any improvement in, much improvement in quality. The other problem, of course, is that, yes, while this new formula will free SPH media from the need to satisfy greedy shareholders. This new formula isn't going to free journalists from needing to please the government. So that will still be there. I do think that we will in fact see some improvement in quality, because the government has assured additional financial support. The incoming chairman has also said that they're going to be hiring. They're not going to be, continue with the pattern of the last few years, which let go staff and so on. So I do expect a noticeable improvement in the quality of the Straits Times and its sister papers, but, nowhere close to what a city like Singapore deserves. Come on, we are one of the most advanced, educated, cities in the world. We simply do not have the media that reflects that kind of understanding that that our citizens have.
I'm speaking to Sherrian George, professor of media studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University, on the shakeup at SPH. When we come back, we'll discuss best practices and public funding for the media. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Hello, I'm Shazana, and you're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. With me today is Sherrian George, Professor of Media Studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University, and we're discussing the plan to transform Singapore Press Holdings from a profit-oriented company to a non-profit media outfit. One of the issues that came up when SPH announced this plan was the question of editorial integrity. There were some sparks at the press conference when the CEO was asked whether the new SPH could maintain editorial integrity. And he took offense with that question. On that note, though, do you think that we'll see any major changes in terms of editorial integrity between SPH now and when it becomes a nonprofit-driven entity?
There is no reason to expect any improvement. There is some reason to fear that things are going to get worse. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to say. It is possible that there will be some improvement. A lot of it depends on the leadership shown by the new chairman and CEO. Will they do the right thing? It's very hard to predict. But I think it's right for the public to be very skeptical and vigilant. At the moment, all we have is promise of more resources. The pessimists would say that since those resources are coming from the government, that is actually just going to, increase the pressure on the newspapers to play ball, simply because it's going to be not just politically beholden to the government, but even more financially beholden to the government for funding. That is a real fear. It need not move in that direction if the new chairman, who being a former cabinet minister, I think does have some clout with cabinet, and the current prime minister, who has a great deal of faith in him. You need a chairman and CEO of a certain clout to be able to push back against the government demands. I think the SPH papers haven't had that for some time. It is possible that the new chairman will be able to achieve this. So it's really hard to say where things are going to head. But what we do know is that fundamentally the picture is on the change, right? Fundamentally, this is still going to be a press that is subordinate to the political leadership, that is not going to play an adversarial or fourth estate role.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had any suggestions or proposals when it comes to public funding, when governments fund media outlets. Are there certain rules, or should there be certain conditions in place to ensure that media outlets remain independent? I guess drawing from examples around the world, what are some of the key policies that should be there when it comes to government giving money to media?
Yeah, no, actually, there's no shortage of best practices and good models to look at, right? Because for almost a century, we've had this thing called public service broadcasting, starting with the BBC. So most of Western Europe, Canada, Australia, and so on, have been doing this for decades. In addition to that, you've got the Scandinavian model, which is a bit different, with subsidies for basically all news media above a certain threshold, right? So what are the key principles? Number one, and this I know, unfortunately, Malaysians and Singaporeans are equally bad at getting their head around this, but you know, there is a difference between public and state and government and party, right? At least in Malaysia, you know, there's a clearer understanding that party doesn't equal country. In Singapore, because we've only had one ruling party, it's hard, you know, it confuses us, right? So, but that's it boils down to that fundamentally, right? That the government of the day is not the same as the nation or state or the public, and therefore there needs to be, you know, an arm's length relationship between public bodies that fund the media and whoever's in charge in government. So that's how the BBC operates, right? So the money comes from the public purse, but the Prime Minister and his minister do not have you can't apply a quid pro quo that, look, if you want this money, you have to kill this program, or you have to launch this propaganda series or whatever. That's not how it works. One good model is block funding that meets certain very clear criteria. So the state says, look, we're going to allocate this many $1 million for current affairs programming that fulfills certain national objectives, like, for example, for minority groups or for certain educational purposes and so on. So very broad targets, and block funding is provided. How, and as long as the broadcaster or the news organization ticks these boxes and says, yes, our programming will meet these criteria, then the actual content, the way the programs are produced, government has no say, right? So this is how it's done around the world. But unfortunately, in Asia, there aren't that many examples of it. There's NHK in Japan. It's hard to find. But I think, you know, if we're serious about it, you know, if our societies are serious about using public funding, which I think is a good idea, because the private sector is kind of, the market has failed to deliver good, high quality journalism. So by all means, use public funding, but let's not get confused. The public funding does not mean government control, right? And make sure that they don't come together. Yeah.
It's really divorcing the political elements from public funding for public interest journalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Which brings me, I guess, to the question which I'll close our conversation with. And it's something that you mentioned earlier about how Singapore doesn't really deserve the current media environment that it has. I mean, there are people, and certainly the government, I suppose, who would argue that the economic certainty and advancement is proportionate to the trade-off that you make for a little less media freedom, I suppose, or none at all. This argument has held for the past several decades, but how do you argue against it today? Like, how do you see this mindset shifting for a freer media in Singapore?
Right. And I think many thinking Singaporeans I know are no longer persuaded that, you know, it's good governance or even commonsensical to insulate those with power from rigorous scrutiny and competition. Why should politics be different from every other field, right? In every other industry, we know the value of competition. We know the value of external scrutiny. Yeah. So how come politics is insulated? This doesn't make intuitive common sense. So I think there's mounting unease that some of the cracks are already beginning to show, that, you know, that the government isn't at the top of its game, that it's not as accountable as it should be. Too many mistakes are being made. quality of decision making isn't as strong as it should be. And you know, the system is not going to collapse, right? The system is too strong to sort of suddenly collapse overnight. But I think there's a fear, which I share, that there's going to be sort of this gradual decline of performance in the state. And it's nothing to do with the individual genetic capability of individual ministers. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew was a big believer in that, right? Mm. That, you know, he believed ability is really what you're born with and what's trained at the individual level. I think what we're beginning to see is that no matter how smart and able, and even no matter how well-meaning leaders might be to start with, it's very human to simply just get lazy and rusty and, you know, cut corners and so on if you can and so on because of the pressures of the job, right? And good people can underperform as a result. In contrast, you know, even if a person is not so good, you know, the heat of competition, the heat of constant scrutiny and so on can actually make you perform better. And I think that's the argument that I would make for a far more on-the-ball, vigorous press that fearlessly questions government's every move. Yeah, and I think many Singaporeans share that. You know, we could just have a better performing state if it didn't spoil itself so much by, you know, insulating itself from criticism.
What do you think it'll take to actually achieve that kind of change? Do you think we'll have to see a major deterioration in government before, I guess, the push becomes a shove?
Yeah, I suspect things would have to get worse before they get better, because there's not that much incentive for the current generation of leaders to change. I mean, they're still, in spite of people like me and many other Singaporeans being unhappy with the system, the majority of Singaporeans will continue to vote the PAP back into power. So there's no compelling urgency to change. It's possible that, leaders who are taking a longer view recognize that, you know, it is that change is overdue, and for the sake of the future might tweak the system. What we do know from international comparisons is that, you know, the number one politicians are self-serving, right? So the most likely prospect for sudden opening up is the realization among those in power that, you know, that their immense powers might fall into the hands of today's opposition. And then they're screwed, right?
Right. So, okay.
Once they are in opposition, my goodness, things are going to look, all these controls over the press and the security laws and so on are not going to look so attractive, right? So before it's too late, let's suddenly introduce, checks and balances. So just in case we are out of power, then we can count on independent institutions like the press, and they won't treat us the way we've been treating them for decades. And that's probably what it would take. Yeah.
Well, it hasn't worked in Malaysia yet, but we can still hold out hope for Singapore that they come to that realization sooner rather than later. Yeah. Sherian, thank you so much for sharing your insights. So we'll have to catch up later down the road when SPH has actually become the SPH Media Trust sometime in September, October.
Right, and hope that catch up can be when the causeway is open and we can once again visit each other's countries.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed. Let's all hold our breath for that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Sherian George, Professor of Media Studies at the Hong Kong Baptist University. This has been Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Coming up next, we have the 10 a.m. news bulletin, and then the Enterprise team will take you through the rest of the Monday morning. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.